I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, the third Little Atom special from Future Everything. Coming up, a chat with Paul Walensky and Joe Shrewsbury of 65 Days of Static, and then a close encounter with the Space Lady. Paul Walensky and Joe Shrewsbury are of 65 Days of Static, an instrumental band from Sheffield, as comfortable crashing samplers as they are putting guitars through too much distortion, influenced by a technologically dystopian present and an apocalyptically likely future. They can be found filling venues, galleries and headphones with different kinds of noise in their ongoing efforts to find the limits of what being a band can mean. What being a band can mean is what we're going to end up talking about a little bit later in the interview. But first of all, as I've already mentioned, this is my fifth interview of the day, and Paul and Joe are just back off rather a gruelling tour. So you'll forgive us if we're all a little bit frazzled for the duration of this talk. But guys, tell us about... Well, how did this tour go?
Very good.
Yeah, it was really good. We finished last night in York and came straight to Manchester. Yeah, it was a bit more confusing than regular tours, because it was in the middle. We did this special one-off show because we were doing... We did a performance of our first album, which came out 10 years ago, followed by a second set. So that project was quite unusual for us. So whereas we've toured for much longer periods of time... It's felt a lot easier. Mm-hmm. This particular week was it threw us a little bit. So
it also had an interesting disparity between shows, in that the London show where we did the 10-year anniversary thing was kind of sold out, 1,400 capacity. But we also played an art centre that we first played 12 years ago to the day, that hadn't changed at all. Mm-hmm. And last night we played kind of 200 capacity pub, essentially. So more and more that seems to be the reality of doing this, that some places are kind of swollen with people and some places are still... it's quite a lot of hard work. And
yeah.
I think that's reflected across... Someone was saying last night that's reflected across the whole industry. Tickets, people aren't coming out to gigs and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting seeing that firsthand, and it's increasingly obvious that that's what's happening.
Well, we'll come back to the 10th anniversary thing. It's obviously a good thing for us to talk about when we talk about what bands are doing, how to redefine being in a band a bit later on. But for anybody who's not familiar with your work, tell us a little bit about where you started, where you met, how you got going and everything.
We started 13 years ago.
Yeah, about that.
In Sheffield. Joe's from there. I finished uni and stayed there. We started just by making loads of noise, really. I was kind of doing the programming side of things, mm-hmm. and the electronics, and Joe was doing the guitar noise. And we started playing shows, figuring out what we were trying to do. We got a drummer, kind of became more like a... looked more like a regular band, just like four of us, but we still didn't have a singer. Mm-hmm. And the music we were making was quite strange and quite noisy, and somehow, I think just through really heavy touring in transit vans up and down the country for ages and over again, we built up a small but loyal following and eventually put out our first record, mm-hmm. which was The Fall of Math, which would be 10 years ago, and had just enough success to kind of tip us into more touring, and just kind of followed that pattern ever since. There's never been a huge breakthrough moment or massive hit, but every time we do something, it's like these tiny little steps forward that's kind of pushed us down the road, and we're now our sixth record came out in October.
Yeah,
last year, and we toured that between October and sort of now. So that's still what we're kind of doing.
Just add relevant to Future Everything, I suppose. While all that was going on, two other things were happening. The first of which is that the electronic side of what Paul does a lot of, and Si, who's not here today, there was a constant technological struggle to kind of represent live what we were trying to do. Mm-hmm. So that meant lots of crashing computers and stuff that I don't fully understand breaking down. And as we've continued to make music, that's all become updated, which is quite interesting what's actually possible now. Specifically in relation to what we were trying to do, it's like it's almost not an issue anymore. But until very recently, it was a huge issue, technology. And the other thing is that the music industry has kind of completely crumbled around us and is doing so. And we're, in many ways, in an advantageous position in that we've never been particularly big relatively, and mm-hmm. we've never been particularly cool relatively, and so we have quite a strong foundation and quite a good relationship with the people who listen to our music. But it has raised a lot of questions that we're trying to deal with at the moment about how to make records and how music, how the band and album format is relevant to now, really, because I don't know if it's obvious to anybody else, but it seems to us to be it's becoming quite a dull medium, really. Playing live, obviously, will always be fantastic, but albums and stuff are becoming obsolete because mm-hmm. that's not how people buy music anymore. And so we're quite concerned with trying to find ways to innovate what it might be that we can do within being a band.
How would you both, I mean, in a really boring, prosaic category of where to find it in the shop way, how would you both describe the music? But then let's talk about, after that, how the preoccupations in the music have changed, how you, what you think about the music has changed as you've gradually progressed. But, you know, again, really, where would we find it in a record shop?
that might be the problem. if you can find it in a record shop, if you can find an open record shop, I suppose we've made what we see as quite different records. A lot of our earlier output is unfortunately bracketed as post-rock, which is something that we've tried to escape for quite a long time. So in general terms, it's very noisy. It's, I think at one point, it was quite melodramatic, but has hopefully become a lot more subtle. And it attempts to sort of... I don't think we very rarely talk about it in these terms.
In the normal interviews we do, we just refuse to answer this question these days because it's the music journalist's job. I've never really understood. Well, for us, post-rock is kind of shorthand for a band that wants to be Mogwai but aren't as good. They've just got some delay pedals. Whereas that's nothing that we've ever really chased. The only thing that we have in common with that is we don't have a singer, which we forget is still a really big deal, but is apparently still remarkable.
Well, I've also seen it described as math rock, which seems really lazy, as first album does have the word math in the title. Unless you invented that genre, it seems like a really
That seems to make a lot of people really angry, particularly math rock fans who are really angry that we're described as that, because we're not, apparently.
Math rock fans don't sound particularly a scary bunch, though.
You've not seen what I've seen. The fact is that the reality of trying to keep a band of our size going and the kind of hands-on nature of it is mm-hmm. probably the truth is that we very, very rarely think about any of that genre stuff. Mm-hmm. And we certainly don't think about it when we're actually writing music, because that's quite a dangerous thing to do. I think you have to really just write.
Find your own way.
Find your own way, yeah.
But then again, that means that you're setting yourself against... It's easy to fall into those things that for marketing purposes and all that sort of thing, you know, to say, well, this is a thing that's easily categorised as this type of thing. And to do anything more interesting, you're inevitably having to sort of step outside of that and say, OK, well, we're not playing that game.
Yeah, we're used to that now. I mean, we've been doing it for so long and stubbornly avoiding entering any of that that we just kind of... We're now not even invited to those kind of parties. We're just left to our own devices somewhere in the gaps between the genres.
So let's talk about how it's changed then. So how was the way that you've approached, if we, you know, again, we're talking about albums now as being a sort of redundant medium, but it's still the best way to get into the, you know, into the music in those points. So how have they progressed as you've gone along, I guess?
Well, actually, I suppose the album is our chosen medium and continues to be, and it was a little bit like James Bridal was saying before about books being kind of already being superseded, but they'll be around for a while. I don't think we've completely abandoned the album as a format. And particularly our last record, I think, is much better listened to as a whole. In terms of writing music, I think as much younger people, we were throwing a great deal of ideas up against the wall to see what stuck. And in a sense, we were free from the generation before in that we were of a generation where you were allowed to take influences or ideas from many different sources and mash them together. But in another sense, we also hadn't learnt to focus that into a simpler idea. So a lot of that listening back is overly complicated, I think. And I think one of the main things that's changed is the ability to use less strokes, less things. So a relative minimalism that is by no means minimalistic, but it's relatively minimal, yeah.
You've been in a band pretty much concurrent with the downfall of the idea
collapse
of being able to make
a
sensible living as a I was going to say a pop star. That's obviously not the not the right terminology, but yeah, the collapse of the record industry and the rise of file sharing, the rise of MP3s and stuff. So I want to get us on to talking about the realities now of being in a band. You said at the beginning when you started, it was you're on that treadmill of release an album, relentlessly tour that album, a year later release another album, tour that album, and that's clearly still happening. I mean, you are doing that same thing now.
To a point, yeah, but that's a really dangerous approach because writing a record to be able to go on tour is absolutely the wrong reason to be writing a record.
Yeah.
You need to write a record because you've got something to say to try and express. So we've always been very careful to not let ourselves get tricked into doing that cycle, which would make much more sense financially, and for any label that was trying to work with us, it would help them a lot to be able to build some momentum. But that just doesn't feel right for us. Additionally, we've never actually made any money from our records and the sales of them. I think pretty much all of them are yet to recoup the money that got invested in the first place. It's amazing that people are still willing to let us make them, really. So our survival comes from the touring, which used to be easier, and it enabled us to not write records for the sake of writing records because we could just keep touring. And for a while, as technology got cheaper, that got easier for us because instead of carrying around lots of samplers and keyboards, you could just carry around laptops. And we're certainly not purist in that kind of approach to music. So it made things easier. It meant we could fly to places without having to spend thousands of pounds on excess baggage. That was good. But now everything's sort of catching up with us from that side of things, and touring's getting a lot more expensive and a lot more difficult, and we're still not making any money from records. In fact, less records are getting bought than ever before. So everything's diminishing.
So what then does the record, what's the point of the record? What does the record become into? What does that symbolise to you as people in a band? Because do you need to keep continuously making as if you're not making the record to then tour that record? Do you see what I mean? It becomes why not just continuously tour for years and not go through the trouble of making a new record?
Well, for us, on one level, we're not quite successful enough to tour indefinitely.
Sure.
Because there's a danger if you start going round and round too quickly, to the level that we do, people will stop coming to see us because they'll assume we'll be back in 6 months' time. It doesn't sustain itself.
I think this is about there's a very real tension between the industry and the people that are trying to make the music, particularly down here at this level. And the problem is that the whole industry is geared towards supporting album releases.
Sure.
And secondly, we're not 21 or 19 or 15. We're not coming up now. We also grew up in an age where the album was sort of the accepted medium. And so we're almost probably, in that sense, very outdated in our approach to it. And I'm not entirely familiar with how people are releasing things yet, but they don't seem to have come up with a particularly great antidote or alternative to the album format.
I mean, it's still a value, isn't it? It's like the novel thing. Novels have kind of been settled on as a form for a really long time, but that's not made them old-fashioned or irrelevant. And albums, they don't seem to have been able to evolve. You don't really, they're still around the 45-minute mark, mm-hmm. even though, you know, typically, even though with digital, they can be as long as you could
But
imagine.
It's still, again, as James was talking about the books, you know, the music itself still exists as an artifact, whatever form it's in, whether mm-hmm. you're playing it live or whether it's a digital file or whether it's on an album, it's still a thing, and there is still something that's seen as culturally more worthwhile of, like, a long, you know, a long release. Than yeah. constant singles, isn't there? I mean, it seems
yeah,
like
and
it's more of a piece of art if you're releasing a long-playing record.
And the form of 10 to 12 songs mm-hmm. around 50 minutes, something like that's been tried and tested,
yeah.
and it remains for us like a good... It's a really good way of expressing a certain set of ideas, because not a concept record as such, but a way of looking at similar ideas from, mm-hmm. from different angles. It's really good, it's just... It doesn't seem, especially going to conferences like this and seeing people like James Bridle talk, there is a very strange new future that is happening now. And these tools that we have currently as musicians don't necessarily feel like the best ones.
Yeah.
Like the album, it's a great thing for expressing certain ideas, but not necessarily the best thing to reflect the world, at least the world that we're seeing around us.
But also, I guess we do tend to forget, because we've all grown up with albums, and that is the way most people, and probably most people in this room, in sort of interface with music, is through that form still. But I guess we do forget that, you know, in the history of music, played music by human beings, the album has been, like, you know, what, 100 years or something, probably a little bit more than that. But, I mean, it could be seen in the long run as just a form that's a blip on that landscape, and perhaps, you know, going forwards, what other ways are there that you can... You know, beyond performing live and obviously digital releases and things, perhaps there are other formats that will supersede it. And in 20 years' time, we'll look back and think, why did we think that was a thing that needed clinging onto as a cultural art?
For sure.
I mean, I'm not sure if people do sit and listen to albums all the way through anymore. I haven't actually thought about whether I do or not, but it's definitely something I do less and less.
Yeah.
Partly through the transient nature of the last 10 years and stuff being in storage, but. Also, don't immediately reach for vinyl or CDs because it's so easy to reach for a computer or an iPod mm-hmm. and it's just there. So while I'd protect the creative sincerity of the album and want it to be conveyed like that, actually, I think there's a fluidity to the digital nature of the music where, and that's fine, people have greater access to the music through the internet, streaming and stuff. I mean, we released a single on Monday, or our label did, but it doesn't exist mm-hmm. as a single, and so it almost has been completely swallowed. Now, the label's motivation for releasing a single is to promote the record further, get the music on the radio, get the music heard in some way. Mm-hmm. But then, so because of that, there's no physical evidence of the single, there's no 7-inch. Mm-hmm. I would argue that that's not necessarily what you would describe as a single in the mm-hmm. classical sense. It's...
PR tool.
It's a PR tool. It's completely ephemeral.
You've just been on a tour. You can't sell that on the tour
and
that you've just been on.
As a band, it has no... It's almost deemed... There's very little motivation to kind of... Well, there's a lot of motivation to try and make that interesting, mm-hmm. but the argument that we're having with the executives in our lives are how can you expect us to want to sell something mm-hmm. to people digitally when they already own it in an album format, mm-hmm. whether that be digital or real. And so for us, it's just... very disappointing that the label, and not to attack them specifically, but therefore the industry itself, hasn't actually found a mechanism to kind of provide something exciting. Mm-hmm. And for us, we really shy away from doing that because it just feels like regurgitation to us, and therefore it's really, really unexciting. Mm-hmm. We know that if people want to listen to that song individually, they'll go to Spotify, they'll go to iTunes, they probably already own it. It doesn't need to be done.
But then it's paid advertising. It's like, you know, it's like you're buying advertising space by doing that rather than putting an advert in a magazine. You know, it just performs the same function in the end.
Yeah, I suppose so. But then that's one thing, I guess. But then asking
people... It means you've got to do
people,
the work, right?
Asking people to buy it is the real problem. I mean, it does exist on iTunes as a single. And the way that we found a way to be comfortable, you know, getting behind it by... putting a B-side there, which is available to buy, and we could shout about that mm-hmm. because it's a new song that we feel has worth. So we kind of ignored the single, really, but talked about the B-side that we've released. And yet on iTunes, you can buy the single, it's called Taipei, you can buy it for 79p, mm-hmm. but it's just... I think they put the radio edit up there. So at first I thought it was just going to be the identical MP3 that would be on the album. So there's absolutely no... It's not on in a nice 7-inch or a cassette. It's not. It's just the exact same data, except they put the radio edit up, which was never designed to be... I mean, that's just... It's had a minute shaved off
It's the same thing, but shorter.
DJ might play it, but it's less good because of it, you know, so... It's all very silly.
So this, the tour that you've just done, you've mentioned that, you know, one of the dates you did this, basically played through the fall of math, because it's the 10th anniversary of it. And the preoccupations of your music are about the future and about trying to think of new ways to be in bands. And this is, a step into nostalgia, really, isn't it? It seems like... And it's a thing that's risen up. People have been doing this for a few years, this idea that it seems like a good banker, you know, it's like this is a good bet because there's a built-in audience out there of fans who would buy this. So how do you tell us how you actually feel about doing that? I think you're probably a bit ambivalent about it.
Well, firstly, we are very ambivalent about doing it, but we have to remember that there seem to be a great deal of people who want to see that.
Yeah.
And I have to say, if we're going to present things in an album format, then it's disingenuous to turn around and then be quite annoyed that people might want to see it. However, this is a trend, I think, for looking backwards that has possibly always been part of music since it started to kind of lose ground as technology grew past it. From when it was initially quite exciting in the 60s and 70s, I think it was at the forefront of actual cultural change. But since then, as things have bypassed it, I think the trend to look backwards is more and more important to the people who are trying to sell the music. Yeah. So this is a sort of something that comes from above then, from, again, the kind of executive level. And they're right, that has sold a number of tickets. It's allowed us to do a tour when we wouldn't otherwise have been doing a venue of that size. And then again in Europe in April, we'll be doing it. However, that highlights again this huge tension that we have between this group of people who want to sell the music and us who want to make the music, who have absolutely no interest. Going over what we did 10 years ago, I mean, we play a lot of that as part of a much more updated set now, but actually revisiting it as a whole makes very little sense musically.
Especially in the live context, anyway.
Yeah, so this is what I was going to say next. So what's it been like to revisit it yourself as musicians? As people that created that 10 years ago, everything about you has changed, your music has changed, you have changed. What's it been like to revisit it?
Well, on the one hand, it was really nice because it made us realise that we have, in our opinion, got better at all of this stuff like over the past 10 years. The songs still stand up on the record, which is reassuring, even if the production maybe doesn't of that particular record. But the strangest thing was, I mean, we've learned to appreciate that. Well, it's kind of about the thinking of trying to expand what it can mean to be a band, really, because there's the live shows and there's the recorded albums, and those are like the two main templates. And we've spent the past decade working out how to be most effective in each context, and it's a very different approach needed for each one. But the nature of this project, where we were taking something that was designed as a record and recreating it live, I mean, it worked. It was a great night, and the crowd loved it, and it was great playing to a crowd that was so receptive and loved it. But at the same time, it didn't really work as a live show, or at least it wasn't half as good as the kind of live show we know that we can put together. Because, like Joe said, half of those songs we do still play live, but in sets of more material that are designed to have some kind of flow to them. But the record, as it turned out, playing it from start to finish, for us, was quite a disjointed process. And that's a strange contradiction of mixed feelings about the whole thing, really.
You mentioned, obviously, you know, it's sold tickets and people have enjoyed it. You talked before about, right from the beginning, having a certain relationship like a close relationship with your fans and supporters that, you know, a much bigger band would not necessarily have. And a band that's obviously connected, network, you know, on the internet these days and all of that. So how has it been received? I mean, do you think, how did it go down?
Very well. I would tenuously suggest, I think, I'm just trying to get a handle on what it is that I want to say is wrong about going back and doing that. If possibly it's the whole culture of playing albums that were written 10 years ago indicative of a sort of anxiety about what the future actually is? Because when you watch an album all the way through like that, you know what's going to come next, and that's precisely what we don't know is going to happen. And I think that's that's my problem with it, is that the walking on stage to do that, everybody knows what they're about to hear and they know what order they're going to hear it in. Whereas what strikes me about coming to Future Everything, this is the second year I've come to the conference, is that a lot of the things that we're talking about are being talked about in there are very exciting and not as scary as I think they're actually going to be. I think the actual future when it gets here is going to be pretty grim and terrifying because of a lot of the climate issues, the population issues that are going on. So maybe it's a safety to go and watch something that you know about. It's a nostalgia that I don't think it's entirely a good thing.
It's almost as if as well that there's a nostalgia that's false. I'm thinking of, like, we're in Manchester, right? So, like, you know, recently, you know, the Stone Roses reformed and did things, and the hysteria around that and people buying tickets, it seems like far more people went to go and see the Stone Roses reformed gig than probably did when they were playing, when people liked them. It's almost like there's this idea that people have of perhaps a time in their lives that were better and more carefree, that they're sort of clinging to in difficult times as well. So on the one hand, the music industry is looking back to a perceived golden age of when it might have made more money, but at the same time, people cling to that nostalgia as if that's got some worth to them.
I think that's what the music industry does, and that's what it's always done, and that's not necessarily the end of the world. But the problem is that if that's what the music industry demands from its artists, and then when you're in an economic situation like we're in now and there is no spare money, everything's tightening, is that the industry fails to reinvest in itself and promote new things. So you're always being asked to kind of build on past glories, and no one ever kind of gets to stick their neck out, or where that's happening, it's happening really, really underground. And even in the 13 years that we've been going, radio in this country has become a lot more... He was only one guy, but we lost John Peel, and immediately that began a slump into radio programming. At the same time, digital, you know, you've got radio stations galore on the internet, but there's no kind of the ability to reach a lot of people, so everything's quite disparate. So I think that is what's not... The effects of that are not quite with us yet, but it's harder for young bands to access studio time, to access radio, to access the kind of the proper tools to make music, because the industry is reinvesting in what already exists, and that's not great.
So let's talk about ways of redefining then what it means to be in a band. Recently you've done basically an art installation. Tell us about this, Sleepwalk City. Give us a description of what that actually was, and then we'll talk about why you decided to do it.
It was in Sheffield at Millennium Galleries. There was a music festival called Tramlines, which we'd headlined one of the stages the year before, and they wanted us to come back, but we didn't just want to do the same thing again because it would just have been the same thing. But they gave us this space and said that we could do whatever we wanted with it within some vague budget that was available. So we basically filled it with noise in the end. We got 16 speakers, two rows of eight, and then hired a massive PA and put that at the end of it as well, and created... Well, it was sort of done in two parts. We did... there was a looping 20-minute installation throughout the day full of all of this drone, which was coming out of the different speakers and moving around, or static, so people could move around and change what was happening depending on where they were in the room. And then we did 9 performances over 2 days of a song from our new record called Sleepwalk City, but we did a 30-minute version of it and used the weird surround sound system that we built to kind of push that song into space in a way that you could only exist in that space, that you couldn't recreate either at a normal live show or on record, just because of the nature of this weird thing that we built.
Essentially able to make the noise travel around the room, because imagine this is the stage, this is the PA, and then there's 16 speakers heading backwards, and you have a captive audience in the middle, and then so we're able to reach each of the speakers individually and put 16 separate things plus the front, so you can literally send waves of sound or cross sound, meaning that really you had the ability to affect people sheerly by volume, and because it was quite intense in the middle. And
because we did like zero research into, you know, the acoustic properties of the room, or indeed any kind of acoustic theory. And 16 was a good number because we knew that we could get our computer to output 16 different things. But that kind of naivety, I mean, we've been making it up as we go along for And there's something really important about making it up as you go along. And you could probably do what we did with a surround sound system if you know how to use a surround sound system properly. But because we didn't, because we built a new thing, then that kind of motion sickness that we created, if you really stood in the middle of it, is something that was new and ours. And controlling that and kind of, it led to a level of intensity and confusion that we really enjoy. I mean, it might not be for everyone, and it might not be as sophisticated as a professional sound installation, but it was a lot more... It was a lot closer to what we were trying to say, which was kind of that we're confused and scared about all of this stuff that's happening.
So how else did you express that? I mean, what else was going on?
The visual side of things was... The daytime installation was Google Maps, but we kind of mirrored that. We took a lot of sites that are visible on Google Maps, and this, it was put together quite fast, but can you remember some of the sites? Because I'm just kind of trying to...
Well, it was based on some of it was based on the places, like China and Australia, juxtaposed with the super rich harbours and the dirty coal.
Sydney, and because we'd just been to Australia, we did a tour, we went to Australia and China, which we were very lucky to do, and in a matter of about 24 hours, 48 hours, we were in Australia on... At the time, the hottest day they'd ever had on record, which I think they're talking about living underground in 100 years' time or whatever. And there were very large trains of brown coal moving towards the coast to be shipped to China. Mm-hmm. We then flew to China, part of the problem. And they then experienced the most polluted day that they'd ever had on record and essentially blacked out the sun, and we all got very ill. And that's obviously a ring of coal power stations burning brown coal that Australia's selling them. And so... quite lucky to see that human effect on the planet firsthand over quite a large scale. I mean, one thing follows, you know, the other. And so that was quite fresh in our heads.
Then there was also Prism broke while we were making all of this. And like, because we conceived of the installation while we were making the record, we also had this in mind because of this idea of trying to push stuff into a new form, you know, not just a record, not just a live show, some third thing. But,
of course, as everyone's probably realising, the reason that we do all this with noise is because we're really bad at articulating it.
Yeah. that's kind of what it became, because, you know, Snowden did his thing and just everything went crazy. And we were all avidly trying to take in all of this information and process it. And a huge admirer of people, again, like James Bridle and Trevor Paglin, the photographer, and mostly people I've heard of at this conference.
Sure.
It's Timo Arnell, is it? And this idea of making invisible infrastructures visible because we currently lack a vocabulary to talk about it. So all of that was coming into us, and we were trying to make visuals for this installation because we wanted it to be immersive, not just in the sound aspect, but visually as well. And it was kind of just smashing it all together because...
What we had at our disposal was scale and volume. And so we built these sort of Rorschach mirrored cities or countries going into each other that we'd taken wholesale from Google Maps. And that was... Obviously, we had the 16 tones going on. And it was... The scale of it was very daunting. And I think the surveillance aspect of it was very, very clearly...
It was overt in the presentation.
Absolutely, yeah.
But also, what we were going for in the end was trying to be honest, because we don't know how to talk. Like, all this stuff is happening. We don't really know. We're not the people who can explain this to anyone. We can only reflect the confusion that we greet it with.
And you can also, you know, really overtly displaying that as well, in that, you know, you're talking here about not necessarily feeling you can articulate it in words, but, you know, you're a band that does music.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is what it all boils down to, is that there's still something incredibly powerful and visceral about loud music and noise. And
very few people in music seem to be trying to engage with this. And on the other hand, I think there's also a really strange culture of actually suppressing any sort of political, ideological views at all in music. And I know a couple of examples firsthand. Can't really say where bands have been told to kind of not speak about things that they've done, and I don't know why that's happening. Everyone seems very, very scared of criticising anything at all, and I think music's at the forefront of that sort of collapse into becoming very mundane, and it's losing its mechanism to actually try and change anything, and I think that's what worries us.
Do you think then, do you deem it a success? Is this something you want to do? You want to do again? How was it received? And what did people actually came and saw?
I think it was received really well.
Yeah.
We learned tons of stuff doing it. I mean, apart from anything else, we never realised how much control you're allowed to have. We're huge control freaks anyway. But with live shows on the tour, you kind of have to take what you get. Mm-hmm. Venues are venues, and you have to find a way to make it work within those confines. But we got to the art gallery, and they were moving walls for us and pulling up the floor to hide wires, and you didn't realise the level of control you can have over a space. So I don't know. There's something we're new to exploring, but it does feel like there's something to be said there for. Well, I mean, I know sound installations are in no way a new invention, mm-hmm. but it would be nice to think that we can bring something of the... I mean, we might not be as articulate as some other artists in one respect, but we do have that kind of... We know how effective the power of a kind of old-fashioned live show can be, mm-hmm. and it'd be really good to somehow harness that power and bring it into these new spaces because, well, it just feels like there could be some use.
Can I just add to that? I don't think it's about... inarticulacy, I think it's actually about the fact that this possibly presenting stuff like that speaks to people on a much more visceral level. You don't have to back it up with academic knowledge of what you're talking about. It's very, very obvious that the media's not really getting this right. What we did in the end was throw up a lot of images, simply images that you see all the time that are horrendous things that were happening at the riots in Istanbul, the Iraq War.
The Google robots.
Just all of this stuff is right there in front of you, and a lot of people at this conference have a lot of people who are speaking have the ability to articulate what it is that's happening, mm-hmm. but a lot of us don't have that ability. But we have all these other things that we have to offer. And actually, I'm personally just simply tired of living in specifically in Western Europe, and possibly. This is a British problem, but it's very hard to find a mechanism for that fear that you feel is happening, of what's happening around you. There's no political outlet for it without resorting to grassroots activism, which is being suppressed by governments anyway. So to fill a gallery with pictures of this stuff that you see all the time, mm-hmm. and instead of soundtracking it with Jeremy Paxman, BBC, Toe the Line, what you have to watch on Newsnight... instead, just backing all that with horrendous volume and noise was just so satisfying to actually say that what this represents, what we see every day, what this represents is something really, really terrible that we ought to be trying to change. That's all. And it's okay for that to be the beginning of something bigger, yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
What's next? Have you got plans to do a similar thing?
We've got some ideas in the pipeline. The thing about Sleepwalk City, as usual with 65, is that we inadvertently used like loads and loads of equipment to make it work, and it didn't come cheap. Mm. So, I mean, we tried to get it to Future Everything, to tell you the truth, but they couldn't find the right venue for it, mm-hmm. And then we were on tour, so it didn't happen. But it'd be great to rebuild that,
or we're working on more things, but we're waiting for the right sort of way to present them. The way that we dealt with this useless single being released by the label was to put out a B-side or a track that we had, which we were saving for something else that we never got off the ground, which is it's called Drone Not Drones. And our idea was to get a lot of people to contribute ambient or drone music, mm-hmm. and basically try and crowdfund vinyl and whatnot, and try and give money to the relative anti-drone stuff, but we haven't actually got around to getting that off the ground. So in the meantime, we've released the music. And mm-hmm. and this was, someone in America has already done a 28-hour drone installation called Drone Not Drones for precisely the same reason. So hopefully, if we do it, maybe someone else will just pick up on the whole thing.
But I think I saw that on the website, that somebody else has, that, you know, started the thing off. Somebody else has taken it and...
We can't. It was a catchy slogan that we thought we'd come up with, and we ran with the idea, but unknowns to us, someone had beaten us to it last year.
Oh, I see. As
well, we didn't find that out until
we didn't take the baton from you and carry on.
We accidentally stole their baton.
But they're into it, you know, to that happening, and I think the idea now might be that other people name whatever they want Drone Not Drones, because it's very simple.
I like the idea of somebody running with it, and basically you start a thing off and then it goes off and has a life of its own out there in the web somewhere. All right, well, we'll have to draw it to a close there. So you've been listening to half of 65 Days of Static, Paul Walensky and Joe Shrewsbury on that side. Give them a hand, please.
Cheers.
I'm Natalie Haynes, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
My guest for this chat is The Space Lady, which is the stage name of Susan Dietrich Schneider. The Space Lady is a street performing singer from Colorado, originally beginning on the streets of Boston in the late 1970s, and then a decade later in San Francisco, where she would play for hours to the gay scene. Her sound is a blend of synth-laden pop and proto-techno that evokes the iconic soundtrack artists and early electronic composers. And she's just recently, well, last night, if you were there, was the first gig of your first European tour, Susan. So, I've just sort of described in that blurb how your music is described, but I want to ask you how you would describe what you do.
Oh, what I do is a bootstrap operation. It evolved out of necessity, survival. I was an early runaway hippie. I left my home in Colorado. Not when you think of Colorado, you think of beautiful mountains and skiing. Mm-hmm. But where I grew up was flat prairie for as far as you could see. Although you could see Pikes Peak far in the distance on the horizon. But basically it was ranch land, cattle country, very provincial and conservative. As a teenager, I could not wait to get away to where it was happening, you know, during the British pop invasion, Beatles era of the 60s. So I did. I ran away from college. I made it to college, but quickly found my way to the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. Met up with my longtime partner, Joel Dunsany, there, who at the time was evading the draft. That was very serious for him and me as a consequence. I had participated in some anti-war demonstrations, but upon meeting Joel, we went into hiding. We were really terrified that he would end up spending 10 years in a federal penitentiary, which was the consequence of evading the draft, burning your draft card if you were public about it, which he wasn't. So the first 10 years of our 30-year partnership, we spent pretty much in hiding, literally in a cave at one point.
Wow.
We spent a winter in a cave on Mount Shasta in Northern California. And from there, felt society encroaching even on the wilderness up there in Northern California. So we set out for a place on the map in Canada, in the Yukon wilderness of Canada, a place called Mount Joy. It sounded good. okay, we'll go to Mountjoy.
Is that why you went? So, because of the name?
Yeah, just the name. We had really no other indication that it would be a good place. It was probably full of grizzly bears and Arctic winters. But we headed north in an old, I think it was a 46 Plymouth that we found for cheap. Got to the Canadian border, and they turned us away, saying no one would be able to fix that car if it broke down in Canada. At least that was their reason for turning us away. It might have been Joel's beard and long hair and our hippie attire, but might have suspected we were running from the draft. So
when did the performing start? When did you start?
At that time, Joel was performing, playing his guitar through an early Echoplex, which was a reel-to-reel echo machine. And he would stand on the entranceway of our cave and just play these cascades of notes, which would echo through the trees. He actually did sing, too. He did some cover songs and some originals and wanted to perform as a one-man band, and that's what our intention was when we went on our second try to get up to Mountjoy. We took a ferry boat to Alaska. He had planned to perform there, but Alaska, again, was very conservative. And he didn't feel he fit in or his music would fit in. So some people we met there suggested we go to Boston. By then it was September, and they said that schools will all be getting their fall sessions, and there'll be a lot of young people and, you know, people more receptive to what you're doing. So we drove across country in a VW bus, landed in Boston, and again had severe culture shock. Boston was very provincial too, very staid and old world to us from being from San Francisco. Yeah, he abandoned his musical career at that time. We ended up losing all his equipment in a pawn shop that winter. And I started panhandling just out of desperation in Harvard Square and up and down Copley Square. And a few months into that, or maybe a year, started creating artworks that I would sell on the street. I did pen and ink drawings, and Joel did collages and little booklets of poetry. And that lasted for 7 years until our first baby was born. And at that point, I felt so disenfranchised and disconnected from humanity, really, society, that I was very uncomfortable and felt I owed it to my baby, my little baby daughter, to do something better. And so I picked up an old beat-up accordion, and because I had piano lessons in my childhood, I figured my way up and down the keyboard, and the buttons were arranged in fifths, and I suddenly understood, oh, okay, I can do this, and went down in Park Street Station, and it was an earn-as-you-learn proposition, but people were supportive, much more supportive than I had found. You know, approaching people for money was just the worst. And suddenly, as I played music, people approached me with money in hand and dropped money in my accordion case. That was the turning point, a major turning point.
So in that case in front of you, you've got the hat. So it's when you put that hat on, you become the space lady, the persona. When did that start? How early?
I believe 2 years into my accordion stint, they came out with the first electronic Cassiotone. The MT40, which is what I play to this day. And I was fascinated. Another street musician was playing it. Every time I passed him, I would stop and listen, which was unusual for me because I was so single-minded of purpose to get that money to support my growing little family. But I would stop to hear him and chat with him. And I earned the money to buy one on Christmas Eve that year. And that was a turning point. I didn't get the helmet until a year following. It was Joel's helmet.
Of course, I described it as a hat, but it's a helmet.
It's a winged helmet.
Can you show it?
Sure. So this was originally the Cosmic Man's winged helmet. And we had found it in, I think, 1971 in a costume shop in San Francisco. And at the time, Joel was making sculptures and paintings on board using little twinkling bulbs he would buy. And he immediately saw the potential of putting a bulb in this ball on the top of the head. The ridiculous ball. I hated the helmet at first. I thought, this is the worst. It's so clown-like. But he wore it with great pride. And as I said, it wasn't until about a year I'd been playing the Casio that he designed a little blinking plastic daisy for me with the bulb in it. And so I wore that for many months. I guess it was about a year because at Christmas time he suggested I wear the winged helmet because of the red ball. I don't know, maybe Rudolph or something. He thought would go over well at Christmas time. I resisted fiercely at first, but then agreed I would do it just this once. And I got such a response. It was just overwhelming. Even people going by on the subway trains would and laugh. And suddenly I got the joke. Okay, this is really cool. It's funny. The wings are symbolic. Mm. Wings of song, inspiration, messenger of the gods, Mercury. I don't know. It just worked.
And where did the space lady come
the
from?
Space lady came, didn't evolve into anything. I didn't have a name all the time I played in Boston. Then when we finally made it back to San Francisco in 1984, people approached me, asked me if I would play for their parties or play in this club, be on the radio show, even TV. I was on the news one time. And, of course, they asked me what my name was. And when I said Susan, they said, but what's your stage name? And I hadn't even thought to have a stage name. So months and months of roiling that over, I came up with Susie Sounds. Our little production company was Amazing Things with the Z's, you know, amazing and things with a Z on the end. So I thought Susie with a Z and Sounds with a Z on the end will fit with Amazing Things. We were producing a little cassette at the time, which was all instrumental. It was more or less the Cosmic Man's brainchild. And in fact, that was the name of the tape, the Cosmic Man. And we were rubber stamping it with Amazing Things as our in-house production company. So that had already evolved. And Susie Sounds just never quite caught on. People got confused and called me Susie Songs or Susie Tunes. And couldn't quite remember Susie Sounds. And somehow the Space Lady just evolved spontaneously. People were referring to me as the Space Lady. So I went with that eventually.
Once you'd adopted that persona, did that change your performance? Did it change the emphasis on the music?
Probably did. Joel was seeking out songs with an outer space based theme. Then Radar Love was kind of, you know, same context, I guess. So I started deliberately seeking out supernatural and outer space themed songs. And I think Joel had that in mind with some of the songs he wrote for me.
So let's talk about the music that you play then, because, well, last night you played a selection of covers of 60s psychedelic numbers, Virgin Prunes, The Beatles, and also some of your own penned or songs penned by Joel or now your now husband, Derek. So let's talk about why those songs, I guess. Has that always been your repertoire, or has that developed as well?
Well, it's still developing.
Of course.
More committed than ever to conveying a message of love and peace and harmony. And so I've dropped a few songs and added a few songs. I'm writing songs now. And of course, Eric has a huge repertoire of songs of transformation, as he calls them. And so I'm drawing on his songs as well. As I said last night, I have a talent for seeking out men who are great songwriters and getting them to marry me. So I'm really blessed.
You've just mentioned that there's a message behind what you're doing, is the philosophy that you're trying to portray. How do you think that comes across to the people that are watching? How do they receive that?
It seems to be overwhelmingly received, and even the songs that are on the album, which I recorded in 1990, and I thought were very dated, seem to have taken on a life of their own, thanks to Michael Kasparas connecting with us and releasing the album on Night School Records. It's just transcended any expectations that I had. In fact, I'd given up. I'd hung up my music in the year 2000 and gone back to Colorado to care for my parents. And I thought it was all history. I'd said my piece. It was time to pass the torch to the younger generations at this point. At least two, maybe three in county.
So well, let's go back to before that point then. So when you started first performing in the early days, you've talked a little bit about your life before Joel and yourself started performing. And then obviously there's a, if it's not impolite to say, a few decades between that and the year 2000 when you decided for the time being to hang up the helmet. And tell us a little bit about the life you led trying to, you know, to make a life for yourself as a performer and an artist, because it seems like you had, again, an eventful time of it.
Starting with the accordion playing, it was an uphill climb, but again, it was just, I gained so much self-respect and respect from society at large because I was making a contribution. Mm-hmm. Although I had tried to make a contribution as an artist with my drawings and Joel's collages, it wasn't in a context people could grasp. Mm-hmm. You know, I was basically a street waif, you know, dressed in very grubby clothes. We were living in squats, and it was hand to mouth. Mm-hmm. And we didn't feel like we belonged. We felt like refugees in our own country. And it was a very demeaning time for me. We had cut off contact with any friends and family for 10 years. There was very little support, very few friends in Boston. We were just afraid. We were living in fear. Mm-hmm. And it permeated everything. And the breakthrough was finding that I could still exist underground and play music, and people appreciated it so much more and interacted with me, spoke to me. And I guess I found my destiny there. I suddenly realized where my bliss was, mm-hmm. where my bliss was, so I could follow my bliss, as Joseph Campbell so wisely advised us.
You mentioned there, you know, the underground scene, sort of, you know, mm-hmm. adopting you, and the songs, as I said, the cover versions that you play, there's a lot of psychedelia.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, no doubt, in San Francisco at that time, there was a lot of psychedelics. Mm-hmm. And, again, I want to talk a little bit about why the psychedelia in the repertoire, but also, you know, how those two things have influenced your...
Well, the psychedelic era certainly influenced me to drop out mm-hmm. of college and run off to join the hippies in San Francisco. Again, coming from such a small town in Colorado, I was not prepared socially. Mm-hmm. I had very few social skills, no academic training, no way that I felt I could fit in with that culture. So I was, again, living on the outskirts, trying to join, trying to belong, find a way to belong. So, and I thought the ticket to join the hippie culture was to drop acid, smoke dope, you know, take mescaline. So I did. I was completely spun out of my orbit at that point and just pretty much became an acid casualty. I was so traumatized, I could barely speak. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when Joel hooked up with me, he sort of took me under his wing because I couldn't communicate. And he had had some depression in his childhood in Chicago. He came from a big city and somehow related to me and felt protective, and I needed that, and he was a lifesaver in that mm-hmm. sense. But we isolated, you know, the two of us. He was isolated from the draft issue, and I was experiencing that culture shock, and so...
Appropriate soundtrack now, we're talking about.
So we were both very influenced by psychedelics, mm-hmm. and... that eventually emerged in a more socially acceptable way through music, brought me out of myself. Uh-huh.
So I want to talk perhaps a little bit about how that's influenced Joel's writing, your own writing, going forward as well. There's a lot of, I mean, obviously the Space Lady and the Cosmic Man suggests it as well, but there's a lot of imagery, space imagery, UFO imagery and lore in your writing mm-hmm. as well. So let's talk about where that comes from, perhaps.
Oh, boy. Well, we had a close encounter on Mount Shasta. Not that we saw little gray beings or green beings, but we saw a spaceship right over the treetops going... It was going too slowly to be anything man-made, at least in our estimation. It was enormous, probably twice the length of this room and as wide around, like a big, well, cigar shape is how they describe them. And it had emerged from a fog. We were sitting on the side on the mountainside with enveloped in fog the morning that we had planned to go to embark on our trip to Alaska. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't see 10 feet in front of us. So we were sitting waiting for this cloud to lift off the mountain. And sure enough, the sun broke through in this spot right over our heads. And this huge craft slowly passed over us. And we were just aghast. Joel and I and a friend. So there were three of us. We weren't high. We weren't tripping or smoking at that time. We were waiting to drive to Alaska, Mount Joy, Canada, mm-hmm. actually. And so we felt we had been scanned. at close range. And it was such a profound experience. We felt that presence with us forever after. And to this day, I know there are beings out there, and maybe in our midst, that we have no idea, with our limited senses, are watching and maybe even guiding and protecting.
Can we talk perhaps a little bit about the... you've mentioned, obviously, Joel's songs and subsequently Eric's songs and Eric's huge collection of of songs. But do you have a collaborative relationship as well in terms of the writing? I wonder if we can talk about that, how much input you have as well.
Well, with Joel's songs, he wrote them on his little acoustic guitar and then gave me, the lyric sheet with chords. And I would go down in the subway with my keyboard and work out arrangements, which I would eventually perfect to my best of my ability, and then go play them for Joel, and he would usually say, "I hardly recognize it. That's my song? Okay, I get it. Well, I like it. It's completely different." So in the sense that I arranged them, I'm sure, I had a hand in how they turned
out. But arranging them makes them different.
Yes, they definitely were different than his intended.
Your own touch, your own feel.
But what can you do when you're transferring a guitar song to a keyboard? Definitely has to come out different.
So what was the difference then on using Joel's songs and then later on Eric's songs? Are they how stylistically different are they?
Yeah,
are they?
Again, they come out different. I use Who We Are as the key. I use one of the automatic bass lines, which is quite different from Eric's performing, strumming a guitar. And again, he says he likes it, and we harmonize on it sometimes.
Can we talk about then, let's go up to 2000 and after that, and let's talk about when you're in touch with Michael and what happened. How did it come to the album being released?
Well, for quite a while, several years, as far as I could tell, the Space Ladies' music lay dormant and was just receding into the past until I was still getting emails and requests for cassettes at the time still, and often people would request a CD, so eventually I took my tape to a sound engineer in my Colorado town, and he digitalized it, and then I had them pressed at a computer store, and so I had 10, 20 at a time made, and I would send them off in the mail one at a time, maybe two or three a month. And then I got an email from Erwin Chusid, the producer, DJ from New Jersey, who produces outsider music, a term I'd never heard before, but he requested to put one of my songs on his album.
This is Songs in the Key of Z.
Yes.
Yeah, it's an absolute classic now, album
Second
of outsider music.
So that was certainly a breakthrough moment, although I didn't realize it at the time, that it would travel around the world and be heard. I knew it would, but I had no idea it would take root and sprout.
Okay, so before we get to your contact with Michael then, at that point, I also wanted to talk about the outsider music thing, which is, it's an interesting idea because suddenly that brackets you with a group of other people who are all entirely unique, and the reason they're outsider music is because there's nothing to group them with other people. And it's an interesting thing. So that's going to point you towards where you are now and success.
Yes.
But how did you feel at the time? Because there's almost like an implicit statement being made by calling it outsider music.
Yes, and when Erwin Chusid used that term in the email, I related immediately. Oh, that's where I belong. And then I listened to some of the tracks and suddenly understood maybe now that's like the Shags. I got it, why people might like my music, because it's so bootstrap again. And incorrect, another term Chusid uses, incorrect music. So I was happy and honored to be included, having no idea that outsider music was really legitimate outside of New Jersey, maybe. But in Europe and here in the UK, obviously it's well received, and I just feel so welcome here and so appreciated. And then, of course, Michael and two other producers reached out via email about, that must have been 2011, and I had met Eric in 2009, and we married that year, played music together, folk music, and performed his music together, but I'd hardly mentioned the Space Lady to him. He is not a pop aficionado, and so there was a little distance there. But the emails I kept getting, and especially from Michael and the other two producers, mm-hmm. really piqued his interest. So he finally insisted I set up and play for him. And I did have some rudimentary equipment, and I had saved the helmet, thank heavens. So I set up my gear really with great trepidation because I didn't think I could remember how to play mm-hmm. at that point. But as soon as I launched into Ghost Riders, his mouth fell open and he said, I've never seen you so fully expressed. Mm-hmm. You have to revitalize this music and revive the Space Lady's career. So it's thanks to Eric, the space manager, that the Space Lady has grown new wings and is back.
So what happened then once that album was out? How was it received? Because obviously now you're here, I said you're about to embark on this, or you did embark last night on your first European tour. So what's it like to achieve success at, I'm not going to say at an age, because that would be impolite, but outside, you know, you've just mentioned the other generation, probably yes, two generations yes. have come and gone since mm-hmm. you were performing music before, and now you're... you know, competing with them, for want of a better word. What's that been like?
Well, I'm a 66-year-old grandmother of three, and it's amazing to me. Just, I'm in a state of disbelief. I think this must be a dream sometimes. I mean, to use such a cliche is just, it's so true, though. It's hard to believe. And the impact of it is still just barely reaching me after last night's performance. Mm-hmm. At the Manchester Gallery.
And then an art gallery as well, what a spectacular
art,
setting that was.
Classic paintings and sculptures all around. And the room packed with people who were riveted to what I was doing and having that sound system at my fingertips, literally, just I'm transformed. I mean, the Space Lady is in another stratosphere mm-hmm. at this point. And the album being so well received, I mean, we're selling them hand over fist and I'm asked for autographs, and people want pictures with me, and I don't know quite what to do with all this energy.
It's been a while since, obviously, you were street performing, mm-hmm. but is the persona we saw last night on stage, the Space Lady's stage persona, different to what it would have been when you were street performing?
Well, yes. Rarely did people stop. Mm-hmm. You know, people would pass by and maybe toss a coin or a buck in my box. If people did stop, more than likely they would have a European or British accent, which was a clue right there. Mm-hmm. But I had a mantra every time I set up. I would say, okay, if I can touch one person today, then my day will have been worthwhile. And often it was only one. But that person would be overwhelming in their accolades. You know, this is great. This is so different. This is so unique. Keep on doing this, you know, or come to Paris. I'll love you there. You know, Dublin, London. And so that kept me going, but I was never... I never had to deal with an audience. Mm-hmm. I was terrified of that. This is really my worst nightmare, to be on stage and in front of a crowd and on the radio and ad-libbing. I had no idea how to do that.
And you can't tell that. I mean, I was there at the performance last night, and I thought you were stunning. You have a beautiful voice, first of all, but also... your sincerity and directness towards the audience comes out. You know, you've talked about trying to project these ideas of peace and love to the mm-hmm. audience, and that's, you know, that's a metaphorical way of saying it. But you could see that the entire audience was wrapped and was connected to you.
I think it's because I attract kindred spirits, and we're all the same consciousness, finding a focal point. And if my music is the focal point for now, that is a tremendous blessing for all of us.
So what's happening now in the immediate future? So you're here in the UK on a tour. How many gigs are you playing?
Speak to the space manager.
Yes,
I can't keep all that straight.
About 20, but, 20
yeah,
gigs
20
right across
gigs,
the country.
Including busking in between, I hope.
And then what? What happens then, do you think? Where next?
We have a July gig in Roswell, New Mexico, where the UFO crash landed in 1947. We went to the festival last summer, and they paid me well to play there. I made very little in tips. Again, people mostly walk by looking for hot dogs and cotton candy and heavy metal bands. But,
and that's
it's worth going
back. Full circle for you as well, because I understand Roswell is where you were possibly conceived.
That's maybe a stretch, but my parents did live there in 1947, year before I was born. Mm-hmm. Of course, I asked my dad about it, and he said, oh, yeah, it was a weather balloon. They figured that out, a weather balloon. Swamp gas, right? So, you know, they had no credence for that. But it's definitely a nice myth to weave into the Space Lady story.
All right, I'm going to... Yes, I heard that. Go on, mention a Christmas album.
Oh, yes. So I'll be working all summer on Christmas songs because we plan to release a holiday album.
Mm-hmm. So that will be out this coming Christmas 2014.
Yes, working title, The Sacred Space Lady.
Mm-hmm. What sort of... Can you tell us already what sort of tracks you're going to be expected to play? Are they going to be Christmas? Is it going to be Christmas music?
Yeah, it'll be Christmas music.
But no doubt particularly chosen Christmas music.
Yes, I hope to use some more obscure Christmas carols. I have a few in mind, as well as Silent Night per request of my producer, which I'll do a spacey version.
And where is the next gig you're playing?
After Roswell, we're planning for a European tour of how many countries, Michael? 2 months.
But where's the next immediate one here?
Birmingham.
Birmingham. Uh-huh. And when is that? Tomorrow night. So you're in Birmingham tomorrow night.
So I'm told.
So it would seem.
I'm following his lead.
This is the Space Lady, everybody. Please show your appreciation. Okay,
thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter @LittleAtoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.